For Pacifica Radio, June 14th, 2020. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. All right, y'all, welcome to the show. It is Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton. I'm the editorial director of antiwar.com and the author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. You can find my full interview archive, more than 5,000 of them now, going back to 2003, at scotthorton.org and at youtube.com/scotthortonshow. All right, you guys, introducing Jake Johnston. He is a senior research associate at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. That's CEPR.net. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Jake?
Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you here. So, audience, everybody, you remember that there was a coup d'etat somewhat sanctioned by the USA last October down in Bolivia. And we all knew that it was a big fake excuse at the time. And that was the election. The crooked election was the excuse for the coup. And one of the reasons that we knew that is because of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. They came out debunking the debunking of the election by the Organization of American States right away. And the big news now is that now that it's June of the next year, the New York Times has seen fit to print that bitter election, accusations of fraud, and now second thoughts, not by them and not that they'll take any responsibility for the lies that they printed at the time and the position their editorial page took at the time about it. But here they are admitting that the separate guys were right all along. So that's the bottom line here. But Jake, if you could please go back and take us through the story of the coup d'etat against Evo Morales in Bolivia there last October.
Yeah, sure thing. So, I mean, again, as you mentioned, you know, this sort of started in the OAS role and our role in this began with the October 20th election in 2019. Now, you know, it's worth pointing out that there was criticism of Evo's ability to run in general. There was a lot of, you know, accusations that this election was not going to be fair before a single vote was cast, right? Many opposition leaders pledged not to respect the results if Morales won. So this is a highly polarized environment in which this election was taking place, right? And on the day of the vote, the preliminary vote count was suspended. And at that point in time, Morales had a 7.5 percentage point advantage over his nearest competitor. That would be just short of the 10 percentage point threshold needed to avoid a second round runoff election. The next day, the preliminary count restarted, and when those results were processed, Morales had overtaken that 10 percentage point threshold and appeared headed to a first round victory. Now, this is when the OAS actions get really important in terms of this story. On the evening of October 21st, after that update, the OAS put out a press release decrying an inexplicable and drastic change in the result of the trend of the election that undermines the credibility of the vote. Right. And this was latched onto as proof, right, as confirmation that fraud had taken place. And, you know, of course, there were going to be protests no matter what. Many opponents of Morales, again, pledged not to respect these results. But that the OAS would make this call certainly gave credence to those calls and gave legitimacy to that movement and helped consolidate this narrative that there had been an inexplicable change in trend. And that was what was repeated in newspapers all over the world, including in the New York Times. Right. It took us 24 hours, less than 24 hours, to realize that they had no reason to make that claim. There was no statistical basis for it. And in fact, I reached out to a high level contact in the OAS electoral department that day and told him as such that the data didn't seem to back up their statement. And their response was, we know, but Evo shouldn't have been running. Right. And this, so to me, right, this is 2 days after the election.
I'm sorry, who was it that said that to you?
That was a source of mine inside the OAS.
Okay. But that's
again,
important. I mean, a single source, but anonymous source, but inside the OAS admitted to you at the time that, yeah, this is essentially a means to an end here. We know we're lying.
Right, exactly. And yet, despite that, and despite clear evidence, we put out reports, statistical analysis, there was a letter from 100 economists and statistical experts saying that the OAS had no basis for this. Members of Congress wrote a letter to the OAS asking for their methodology and what led them to do this. There was actual attention. Now, very little or any of that was actually reported at the time, right? But they knew these things, and yet they continued to repeat this in report after report after report after report. And it's that initial claim now that the New York Times is reporting on and, you know, citing this new academic study that basically confirms our previous findings, though the new thing is that they actually had access to the same data set that the OAS did. Now, for months and months, the OAS has refused to release their data, refused to release any methodology, and they still refuse to release their methodology. But these researchers were able to replicate the OAS findings, but only if they excluded certain tally sheets from their analysis. In other words, they weren't using the right data set, and they excluded certain pieces of evidence that then resulted in this claim, clearly not backed up by any statistics.
Mm-hmm. And now, as I understand it, basically what happened here was they counted all the city votes first, where the Indian president obviously has less of a lead, the 7% you're talking about, and then all the returns started coming in from the countryside, where all the Indians live, where he has a much higher margin of victory. And then they say, oh no, something, you know, irregular must be taking place here when it's perfectly regular.
Yeah, that's right. So when we started looking at the data, right, it actually, you know, it wasn't even, you know, early returns all one thing, late returns all the other. There was a steady progression as the votes were tallied, right, that slowly and Morales' lead slowly built as more and more votes were tallied because of that dynamic you mentioned where more.
So it wasn't even a big shift. It was like it was a kind of curve on the chart as the rural votes came in. Interesting.
Right,
okay.
Exactly. These updates were provided every 3 minutes, right? And so we, you know, you can look at the data. It was publicly available and look at these updates every 3 minutes, right, over time. And you can see the lead slowly building, slowly building, slowly building from morning till evening, right? And so again, you know, this is really simple, but I mean, if you're the OAS, right, I mean, I think anyone who's witnessed an election just from sitting at home and watching CNN or something, you know, is aware that, you know, you zoom in on a little rural county and say, oh, there's 0% reporting here, right? How might that impact the results, right? This is pretty basic stuff here, right? That the OAS didn't even consider these geographical explanations, you know, is a real sin of omission.
Mm-hmm. And again, because they had an agenda here, any excuse to get rid of this guy. And so about that, just how badly was he abusing his power attempting to stay in office here, do you think?
Well, look, I mean, I think there are legitimate critiques of Morales on many issues, right? But none of that doesn't really change the fact that, you know, the OAS, right, this is a regional organization, this is a regional institution, right? Nothing allows them to simply lie about the facts, and especially when the end result of that is a coup government using those OAS lies, right, to justify their actions, right? And
right.
So, you know, I think you can have a much broader conversation around, you know, the local dynamics in Bolivia and criticisms of Evo, et cetera, but that's really not what this conversation has to be about, right? This is about what the OAS did, specifically what the OAS did. And that has impacts for Bolivia, but it has impacts for the entire region, right? The OAS observes elections in every country in the hemisphere, basically, right? And so can we trust them to be credible? Can we trust them to be neutral? Can we trust them not to intervene in political affairs of sovereign nations when it suits their interests, right? And that, I think, is what's most important today.
Except that, you know, the problem, of course, is that the American government's position is that, no, it's democracy that's more important, and that's why we have to save it when people are abusing it. And this kind of thing, they're invoking a higher morality in order to justify this kind of thing. They constantly do. And so, you know, I thought it was important to note, as Glenn Greenwald did, that, geez, Netanyahu has been in power since 2009, and Angela Merkel has been in power, our great ally in Germany, for whatever, 16 years or whatever it is over there. And you don't hear the Americans crying that that's the end of democracy there. She keeps getting reelected. And so what's the problem? As long as they're friends of ours, even look at all this strife going on in the electoral system in Israel. Netanyahu comes out on top after four elections or whatever it is. Fine, whatever. He's our guy. Our guys are his guys, whatever it is. It's fine. But in this case, oh, this guy, you know, he's trying to finagle himself an extra term in office. And that gets to our highest and most deepest sense of commitment and obligation to our principle of regular Democratic turnover in power. And so even though we have no legal right to do so, it's right for us to stop these, you know, leftist tyrants from seizing power away illegally from their people and all these things, which is, after all, the argument, right? And not just from right wingers. This was the argument from the Hillary Clintonite, you know, center left liberals last October.
Certainly there was widespread sort of acceptance of, you know, these claims of fraud at the time, you know, across the political spectrum. You know, there were very few voices of dissent at the time. You know, and I think, you know,
and notably, this wasn't a Barack Obama era coup, right? This is a Trump era coup, and you still have liberals going along with it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this gets to sort of a bigger and more systemic problem, right, which is that there is a willingness from foreign policy elites, from, you know, political elites, and from many in the media to simply accept powerful institutions' comments at face value, right? And that's the case here. The OAS said something, and so in the minds of many, it became fact. But nobody was willing to actually look critically at what they were saying and what the basis of those statements were, right? And I think, again, that's what's so key in all of this, right, is you can't simply accept these things at face value. You know, you have to do your own research. And that's what we did, and that's what led to our findings, right? And I think, you know, going back to your point around, you know, Morales' re-election and the controversy over that, you know, I think it is worth noting, right, that there was the highest court in Bolivia did rule that that was constitutional. Now, many, you know, argued at the time that this was a court packed with Morales supporters and it was just doing his bidding, right? And so it wasn't legitimate. You know, never mind, this is a sovereign process. It's their court. You know, it's not really up for us to make that decision. But fast forward to after the coup and the swearing in of an opposition senator, Jeanine Nanez, who is not actually in the constitutional line of succession. And that same high court in Bolivia issued a constitutional ruling providing legitimacy for that process, right? And it was cited by everyone who had been spending years criticizing Morales for his running in the first place. All of a sudden, that same court was perfectly legitimate and reasonable to give the constitutionality to the coup government, right? And so, again, this is not going to come as a surprise to, I'm sure, many of your listeners, but there's a deep hypocrisy, you know, in so much of this and in so much of U.S. foreign policy, right? And I think it's really just on display in the situation with Bolivia.
Hey, guys, Scott Horton here for Mike Swanson's great book, The War State. It's about the rise of the military-industrial complex and the power elite after World War II during the administrations of Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, and Jack Kennedy. It's a very enlightening take on this definitive era on America's road to world empire. The War State by Mike Swanson. Find it in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all. Mike Swanson is a successful Wall Street trader with an Austrian school understanding of the markets, and therefore he has great advice to share with you. Check out Mike's work and sign up for his list at wallstreetwindow.com. And that's what you'll get, a window into all of Mike's trades. He'll explain what he's buying and selling and expecting and why. I know you'll learn and earn a lot. WallStreetWindow.com. That's WallStreetWindow.com. Can you give us exact numbers or a real close ballpark as to what the real vote totals were and just how badly he would have won on that first round if they had just let the election take place according to the law?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting question, right? I mean, you know, on one hand, you know, we aren't the ones who give legitimacy or provide final results to elections, right? So what we are analyzing is what the OAS has done. And now the official results of the election announced by the Bolivian Electoral Council was that Evo Morales won by about 10.5 percentage points, right? And so often this is like, you know, it's a razor thin margin. He barely secured this victory, right? But to be clear, nobody's questioning that he received far and away the most votes. The real controversy becomes, was he just under or just over that 10 percentage point threshold? And again, this is where the OAS says it only could have been possible with fraud. And what every study that's looked at this closely since says, well, actually, it was totally explainable by already released electoral
right.
results.
And now, hypothetically right? speaking, if it had gone to the second round, were there enough other opponents that if they had started dropping out that their numbers could have added up to enough to beat him? Or he already had enough that it's virtually certain that he would have won on the second or the third or whichever then?
No, I mean, certainly there was an impression that it would have been much closer in a second round. There was a number of opposition candidates who had split their vote, right? And so, you know, there in theory would be some coalescing around one candidate for a second round. But it is, you know, worth pointing out, you know, his official Morales's official results, you know, in the first round were him receiving about 47% of the vote. Right. So it wouldn't be that difficult to imagine him also picking up some level of votes from other candidates, as not all of them were, you know, categorically representative of opposition factions, right? Yeah. So again, you know, I think it obviously would have been close, you know, but it was never allowed to happen. And I think, you know, this is important, right? Because after the election, the initial call was there needs to be a second round, right? That's what the OAS said. That's what many in the opposition said. And as things developed over time, those calls turned into Morales must go, right? And so on November 10th, the morning that he was eventually ousted, Evo actually agreed to hold new elections with a new electoral council as a bid to try and avoid the worst, right, and satisfy these claims and comply with the OAS audit, which had recommended as such, right? But it was clear that's not what this was about. It was not about a fair election or having a fair election. It was about getting rid of Evo Morales, and that's certainly what ended up being accomplished.
Yeah. Now, talk to us a little bit about the method of the coup and exactly how that played out, because it actually broke into violence where they burned his sister's house down. And I don't know if any people were killed, but he was chased out of the country, you know, seemingly at the threat of his life, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this is something that's been, you know, systematically sort of avoided in coverage of this whole situation, right? It's treated as though Evo simply resigned, right? Now, I think that totally ignores the sort of broader context which was happening. You know, the police had been mutinying for multiple days. There were certainly protests happening, turning on him. And in the day, critical 24, 48 hours before his resignation, the homes and family members of both Morales and his allies were ransacked. You know, members of family members were kidnapped, beaten, threatened. Right. And that was the greater context of what happened. And it wasn't just Morales who resigned. Right. Key to this is that not only did Evo resign, but so did his vice president and the constitutional line of succession, which were part of his political party. Right. And in that absence is what caused this sort of power vacuum that could be seized upon by the sort of most retrograde right wing forces in Bolivia.
Yeah, and so talk a bit about them. I've heard Morales himself say, this was a lithium coup, which on the face of it, it sounds a lot more plausible than this is a dispute about electoral totals.
Yeah, well, I think this is, you know, it's a dispute around control, right? It's a dispute around power. You know, there are many factions in Bolivia that have never recognized the legitimacy of Evo Morales. And in fact, the indigenous majority of the country, which has been systematically excluded from the political process for centuries in Bolivia. And so that is a huge dynamic. And one of the first things that happened after the coup was, you know, had this, again, a far right senator, opposition senator, Jeanine Añez, was sworn in as president, you know, by the military. The military put this presidential sash over her shoulder. So you get the militarization. But then on the other side, it was also proclaimed as we are returning the Bible to the National Palace, right? I mean, this was a Christian fundamentalist takeover and directly sort of criticizing the indigenous majority in the country.
Aren't they like Spanish Catholics?
Yeah, I mean, Jeanine Añez has in the past referred to the country's indigenous majority as savages, right? And there's been this the desecration of the indigenous flag, which was you know, elevated under the Morales government, yeah, and was seen sort of ripped down from military's uniforms, burned in the streets. So there was a tremendous amount of this sort of anti-indigenous racism that was also at the core of much of this.
Wow. Yeah, well, you know, it's an American-backed democracy when it's the tiny European minority that rule over the majority there. I was just thinking, I mean, usually when you say fundamentalist, that means Protestant. But in this case, you're saying far-right Catholic forces, I guess.
Yeah, that's right.
Meaning the Spanish. And now, can you tell us what's the 60-40 on the population split between the European elite and the Indians?
Yeah, well, it's you know, it's obviously difficult to know precisely. You know, it's a lot of self-identification.
Sure.
I think it's not questionable that there is a majority indigenous population in Bolivia, however.
Yeah. Well, so they must be kept out of power at all costs so that democracy can be maintained. And by the way, for people who, you know, listeners who are interested in how this works, I'd ask you to look at this old Justin Raimondo article from 2004 called The Ukrainian Template. And this is exactly how, you know, it's not really the CIA as much anymore as the National Endowment for Democracy and their allied institutions. But what they do, this is how they do the color-coded revolution most of the time, is wait till they lose an election and then just dispute it and refuse to concede and get out in the street and do everything they can to destabilize the place and force concessions and figure out a way to give the military an excuse to do a coup and this kind of thing. So for those of us who've seen this kind of thing before, we've seen this kind of thing before. There's no fooling a lot of people who got this right last October because of their familiarity with the way that this kind of deal plays out. And it's just like the Orange Revolution and that kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, I think one thing that's important to add too, right, is that this isn't a unique event, even in terms of just the OAS's role in an electoral crisis, right? So you go back to 2010 in Haiti, and there was a disputed election. The OAS was called in to, you know, adjudicate, solve this process, look at the election. And what they ended up doing was, based on no statistical analysis whatsoever or any sort of consistent methodology, they removed tally sheets that predominantly benefited one candidate and changed the results of that election, altering the course of Haiti's politics right today. And so we've seen the OAS do these sorts of improper interventions around elections before, right? This isn't new behavior from the OAS. And I think, again, it's why calling them out on this and having some accountability for what their actions were is so important, because if they aren't held accountable, and the OAS very rarely is ever held accountable for their actions, it's only more likely that they will do it again, right? And in the next electoral crisis, can the OAS actually be trusted to be a credible actor in that process? And, you know, I think the answer at this point is clear that no, they are not credible.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of which, has there been any good reporting about the process at the OAS when they decided to go this way? In other words, the amount of American influence at play.
Yeah, you know, I think this is a key aspect of this that really hasn't gotten the investigative, focus that it deserves, right? So what we do know is the LA Times reported in January that the U.S. representative to the Organization of American States, Carlos Trujillo, he is a sort of far-right Latin America hawk and an acolyte of Marco Rubio. And the LA Times reported that he, quote-unquote, steered the OAS observation mission to reach a determination of fraud, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a key aspect here, right? And again, goes back to this initial press release on October 21st. That's what this, that's where the clear OAS lie first occurred. And we have to know what actually caused that to happen, right? Who pressured them to make that statement? Why did they make that statement? Those are the questions that need to be answered if we want to get to the bottom of what really happened here in Bolivia.
Yeah. All right. Well, and now, by the way, was there anything really notable about that New York Times story other than how hilarious it was that they refused to give credit to anyone who got it right before their final admission here? Eight months late.
Of course. And I mean, I think, you know, this has been the OAS's sort of response, and the New York Times sort of does its job carrying water for this response, which is, the statistics are basically moot because we found all this other evidence of irregularities. Now, a few points on that. The OAS audit, which does include, a number of other irregularities that they allege, was released a preliminary report in November. It was then the findings altered significantly in a final report released in December, a month after the coup and handed over to the coup government. Right. And in that report, you know, we have gone through in detail, that is 800 pages with appendix to the OAS report. We went through it in detail. And what we found was that it wasn't just the statistics that were faulty from the OAS. In fact, they misrepresented key pieces of evidence. They excluded key facts that ran counter to their narrative and actually just grossly misrepresent some of their findings in that audit. Right. And so it's not just that their initial claim was bogus, but in fact, they've consistently manipulated the public record since.
Yeah. Well, just, you know, zoom out of this, from the story a little bit and look at it. I just think, what would it take to really justify an American-supported intervention, you know, like this against the government in Bolivia there? You know what I mean? Most of the time they try to invoke some impending massacre or some fake massacre or some stock of weapons or some kind of thing here. But what could possibly be the justification for this sort of intervention? There's not one. They're simply hooking up their business cronies, is all it is.
Yeah, and I think, you know, again, you look back to some of the motivations around here, and I think a key factor, too, in all of this is the Secretary General of the OAS, Luis Almagro, right? Again, he has become a close ally of the sort of Latin America hawks in the U.S., including Marco Rubio. Mm-hmm. Now, he was running for his own reelection as Secretary General of the OAS while this was happening. And it was certainly seen, you know, his hard stance against Morales and against this, quote unquote, electoral fraud right after the election was seen by the region's right wing governments as sort of a good indication that they could trust Almagro. Right. Mm-hmm. And this was key to him sort of gathering and getting that base of support because he did face some opposition internally. Now, it will come as no surprise that the, you know, de facto government resulting from this coup in Bolivia was a vocal supporter of Almagro's reelection. You know, that's obviously not a surprise. And Almagro did indeed win re-election within the OAS for another 5-year mandate. And I think looking at his role specifically in this is extremely important. You know, he has been the, you know, at the forefront of this effort to politicize the OAS and turn it into an institution that does intervene into these sovereign affairs, whereas the OAS is, in theory, made up of the member countries in the hemisphere itself, right? And so I think that's really important to sort of hold these individual actors in the OAS accountable for their role. Almagro should resign. I mean, this is, there is no question, right? I mean, this is a clear lie from the OAS. And, you know, Almagro, even at the time, went to the OAS and said, there was no coup. The only coup was Evo's fraud on October 20th, right? Now we know that the OAS claim on that was bogus from the beginning.
Yeah. Well, isn't that something about, you know, the internal politics at the OAS? I mean, you could be describing how Mohammed bin Salman started the war in Yemen because of the internal politics in Saudi Arabia, or for that matter, how Samantha Power started the war in Libya so that she could get a promotion from deputy assistant something on the National Security Council. That's how this kind of thing works often, right? The individual political interest of the people involved in carrying out the policy ends up with these massive consequences for other people.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think that's why it's, you know, you really do have to look at all of those different motivations and factors that go into these things, right? And often it is, you know, not related to the actual sort of overall picture, but these very sort of petty personal issues or interests, right, that lead to these tremendous implications in terms of human life, right? And I think that's, you know, an extremely important part of any analysis of this.
Absolutely. And now, so where is Evo Morales now?
So Evo accepted political asylum in Mexico. He has been prevented from running in the next election. He personally said he would not run for president. The Electoral Council has since, or I think it is still ongoing, but has tried to prevent him from running as a senator in those elections. They are currently scheduled for September 6th, though there is obviously concern that the government in power now will not allow those to take place or will further militarize the country. And, you know, again, the amount of repression and violence that we've seen in the aftermath of that coup has been extremely distressing. And the further militarization, you know, would only sort of erode the credibility of that election further. Right? And again, I think, you know, you look back to the sort of motivations, right? And again, beginning, this was an illegitimate election, right? But now we're going forward to this new election under this coup government. And it seems like there are very less voices in the international community worried about the legitimacy of that election.
Yeah,
right? So again, you have to look at the selective enforcement of these principles.
Absolutely right. Well, and I was going to ask you, are there any obvious successors to Morales there on his side?
So there's a number. So Luis Arce, who is a former finance minister, is currently the MAS candidate for president. And David Chocohuanca, a longtime indigenous leader and member of Morales' MAS party, is running it for vice president. I think there has been sort of this rejuvenation of the MAS movement, right, as it's looked to other leaders and looked to build its own movement sort of as in this context, right? And I think, you know, the MAS has made some really interesting decisions in that regard, right, to try and at least, you know, they maintained a power in the legislature, right? The MAS had a majority in the legislature and maintained that. And they've tried to use that to, you know, at least maintain some influence or some control over what is happening going forward with elections. And again, I mean, you know, I think it deserves close attention from actors all over the world. And I think, you know, key, we need different observers than the OAS to be on the ground in September. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, I know where they can find some. All right, guys, that is Jake Johnston, Senior Research Associate at the CEPR. That is the Center for Economic and Policy Research, CEPR.net. And check out their study, Observing the Observers, the OAS in the 2019 Bolivian Elections. Again, that's at CEPR.net. Thank you again, Jake.
Thanks so much for having me, Scott.
All right, you guys, and that has been Anti-War Radio for this morning. I'm your host, Scott Horton. I'm the editorial director of antiwar.com and author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. Again, you can find my full interview archive, more than 5,000 of them now, going back to 2003, at scotthorton.org and at youtube.com/scotthortonshow. I'm here every Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 on KPFK, 90.7 FM in LA. See you next week.